about how the principles of improv theater can be used in conflict resolution. And this KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. And also by The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Thanks for tuning in to KABU today. If you're not a member of KABU, you can change that right now by going to kabu.fm and clicking on Donate Today. That's the way you become a member of this great community radio station.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. Conflict is a source of much of the dis-ease on our planet today, and it can lead to anything from hurt feelings to war. And it's even an issue here at KABU, and over the weekend I was at a meeting of volunteers. We may be rewriting the KABU's guidelines for conflict resolution. My guest today, Barbara Tint, teaches conflict resolution at Portland State University, and she travels the world as a facilitator, consultant, mediator, and trainer in a variety of domestic and international arenas. Barbara also does improvisational theater, and she combines the principles of improv with her teaching and her training. In fact, I read that she firmly believes that improv can change the world. So I invited her on this show because I really wanted to find out how that could work. Improv, save the world. So Barbara, welcome.
Thank you, Stephanie. Nice to be here.
It's great. And further down the hour here, we're going to be taking calls from listeners. Right now, we're just going to kind of talk to Barbara and get it kind of clear how conflict and improv work together. So save your questions and we'll be getting to you. But meanwhile, Barbara, how long have you been working with conflict resolution?
Probably about 20 years in this field directly. My background originally was as a psychologist, and I felt strongly that I wanted to work in larger systems than in individual relational systems. So when I went on to do my doctoral work was in international conflict resolution, but through the lens of psychology. So I've been doing that for a number of years and moving the lens of psychology into larger systems, social systems, political systems, to understand what causes conflict, what we can do to reduce and ameliorate conflict.
And so, and how does that work exactly, the lens of psychology? Like, how would that be different from, like, how it's normally done?
Well, conflict resolution is an interdisciplinary field. It's a relatively new formalized or academic field. I mean, Indigenous people and lots of organizations and communities have been doing conflict resolution for thousands of years, but as a formalized discipline, it's relatively young. So we are interdisciplinary. We have people who come from political science, from law, from philosophy, from communication studies. So each discipline has its own lens. So, for example, from my perspective, from my lens, we look at the psychological needs of individuals and groups and how we form into groups of us and them, and the kinds of needs and issues that people bring at both the micro and the macro levels, which contribute to conflict at small and large scale situations.
And when you're working with conflict, I mean, are there just like general themes that you just see over and over and over again?
Well, yes and no, like most things. Yes, because conflict involves people, and on some level, all people carry certain things universally, right? We all have fundamental needs to be seen, to be connected, to have our identity recognized, to have some freedom in our lives. And the lack of those things drives a lot of conflict. No, because situations are different, cultures are different, contexts are different, and the ways in which people express conflict are different. So it's both yes and no.
Yes and no. And so for instance, like when you're dealing with someone who's really angry in one culture, they're going to like just totally mask that, and mm-hmm. somebody else is just going to be like flying off the roof.
Mm-hmm. And right. Well, as some of my friends and myself joke, and everything is a cultural thing.
Right.
So while we would say that the capacity to experience anger is a universal, the way we express it is different.
Mm-hmm.
And the tricky thing is that oftentimes we express things in ways that other people or groups don't understand. And so that can often be the cause of conflict. So in one culture, if people express anger very expressively, another culture that is much more reserved might think that is a much bigger deal than it actually is to the person expressing it, because for them, that's just sort of a normal way of expressing emotion.
Yeah. And so like then how do you go into this with the psychology of it? You're just really trying to like root out that somebody is really angry, or root out that somebody's, I mean, what's going on for you?
Well, the other answer that is the answer to most questions is it depends. So it depends. I mean, again, part of this work is having enough knowledge and experience in a lot of different contexts to be able to ask good questions, right? When I teach, I tell my students, we don't want to replace one set of assumptions with another.
Mm-hmm.
We want to cultivate our ability to ask good questions, either internally of ourselves or with the people we work with. So we can come in with a certain knowledge base or a certain framework, but it doesn't mean then therefore we somehow know or assume what's going on. It means it frames our inquiry. It frames our ability to explore with people. And people will let us know if we're listening and paying attention what's going on for them, if we give them the space to do that.
And so you go in there, you mediate, you also train people.
Mm-hmm.
How are all these sort of, are they all kind of the same for you? Or, I mean, what's the difference? Like, say, you need to train somebody to be a mediator,
mm-hmm.
and then somebody else, you're actually mediating the
mm-hmm.
situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there are certain skills that might be brought to both of those processes, but they're fundamentally different processes. So when I work with groups in conflict, I am serving a particular role. One project I did for a number of years, I worked with African refugee communities who were living here in the diaspora context, but still carried very much of the historical enmity with them. And so they were living together in apartment complexes or sharing English classes and afraid of each other.
Mm-hmm.
In that context, I was a facilitator. I led groups. I gave people the space, along with my partners in the African community, to process some of these things. When I train, I'm still using facilitative techniques, but I'm teaching, I'm training, I'm helping other people learn how to work with people in conflict. So there's some overlap, but it's different.
And your background also includes just basically traveling, as I said in the beginning, all over the world. You like African refugees here in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
here in Portland, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've been to Amsterdam, you've been to Rwanda, you've been to Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I look at this, France. I mean, you've been everywhere.
Well, I do have a travel habit, and fortunately, I have work that supports it, and the world needs it. The world needs everybody. And there is a challenge sometimes, and some of what my students ask is, who are we to go somewhere else and work with other communities, right? We don't want to reinforce this sort of imperialist notion of being the expert from the outside swooping in to save the world. So there really has to be an element of partnership that you develop with local communities. And you have to be asked. You don't just go in and say, here I am to save the day. You have to be asked. And the reality is that sometimes we're asked because what people and communities are trying isn't working. So the help from the outside is useful. But again, it's a balance.
And you are asked, though, it sounds like. So all these places that you've gone, you've actually been asked.
Sure, yes.
You haven't said, oh, can I come?
Well, I don't know that that's entirely true. Usually when I'm teaching, it's a combination of being asked and offering. Uh-huh. But when you're working with people who have really suffered and struggled in conflict, you have to be asked. And part of that is really through relationships. So through the international relationships I've developed over the years, that's where the projects or the possibilities emerge.
Well, let's start to talk about improv, because mm-hmm. that's actually a huge part of what I was interested in. Mm-hmm. And I know that, like I started this with saying, that improv could save the world. Mm-hmm. Tell me how.
Well, we only have a little time, so okay. I probably can't tell you all, because it is something that I'm deeply passionate about right now. And I believe that improv could save the world, because the fundamental principles of improv are really grounded in such things that are very much the antithesis to conflict. So first of all, improv is a modality that is based on acceptance, people accepting each other's offers and building on them. It's based on principles of generosity and collaboration. It's based on creating shared stories rather than being attached to your own version of a story. And improv as a process, if you participate in it, allows you to access parts of yourself that are freer, happier, more spontaneous, more creative. And I do think that on the individual level, it means that we each bring much better versions of ourselves to everything we do. On a larger level, these are processes that really can engage groups in ways that might help unlock the barriers between them.
So basically, like, for instance, I actually, as I told you earlier, I took an improv class. Mm-hmm. I took one just here at Portland State in the theater department. And the thing that I really loved in the beginning was just how it seemed like everything was about just saying yes. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the beginning of it for me. Could mm-hmm. you talk a little more just about that process?
Yes.
Like the yes
business?
Yes,
I can. Yes, I can. The notion of saying yes is one of the core principles of improvisation. And people worry about that because they somehow think that means they need to agree with everything that's coming their way. And it really doesn't. It means I accept what you have offered. I receive it. I hear it. I'm present for it. And it's not just yes, it's yes and. It means I'm going to build on it. If you're thinking about performance improv, it means you have to work with what people come on stage with. Mm-hmm. So if you think you're rowing a boat and someone comes on stage and says, "Where'd you get that exercise machine?" You can't say, "That's not an exercise machine, you know, that's not an exercise machine, it's a boat." You have to say, "Oh, mom gave it to me for the holidays," yeah. and off you're running. So you have to let go of your agenda, which actually is a lot of where we get locked in conflict, is people are very, very much attached to their own agenda, and they can't really see a collaborative way through to the future. So the principle of saying yes means that you really can work with what other people present in a different way, and you're committed to doing that. And the beauty is that other people are committed to doing that too. So you know that your offers are going to be accepted and built upon.
And heard. It sounds,
yes.
That's the initial.
Yes.
And the other thing, no, it's not a rowing boat, it's mm-hmm. a whatever, is basically somebody's blocking.
Exactly.
And so in a certain way, would you say that normally that there's certain styles that we have for behaving, but that improv is a very sort of going off another direction mm-hmm. style in terms of conflict?
Mm-hmm. Well, improv is a mindset. Improv is a philosophy. Improv is a set of tools, techniques, activities. So it's all of those things. And it's really something, once you learn it, you can choose to be quite intentional about. So you can actually be very thoughtful and intentional about going through your day and being aware of where you're saying no, where you're blocking, where you're saying yes. Again, yes as a way of receiving rather than agreement. And it really, if you practice it, I mean, I invite people to practice it for a week and see what happens, see what changes in their life.
Because, you mean just going around saying yes to anything?
Again, not...
Yes, and...
Well, there's a movie, right? The Jim Carrey movie, you know, The Yes Man, which
right.
was sort of a take on that. I think it's, again, it's more of a philosophy. So sometimes we have a knee-jerk reaction to block. It's sometimes a way of buying
yeah.
time,
yeah.
buying space. We are in fear. We're in fear of losing our own ideas or identity. Saying yes is courageous. It allows us to be vulnerable. It allows us to receive, and it allows us to take risks. So improv is really about taking risks. And when we're in conflict with other people, we're very much blocked, not only to other people, but sometimes we're blocked within ourselves because we're in fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a Keith Johnson quote, something about people who say yes have adventures and people who say no have security.
Well, I have the quote right here, and so I'll read it to you exactly because it's a classic quote. Keith Johnstone, for those who are listening who don't know, he's one of the core foundational improv teachers, and he has said, "There are people who say yes and there are people who say no. Those who say yes are rewarded by the adventures they have, and those who say no are rewarded by the safety they attain."
Right.
What I want to say is that there are times we need safety. So it doesn't mean that, therefore, you cannot ever say no. We need safety sometimes. And sometimes adventure, again, for people particularly who have been traumatized, safety and security are very important.
Our high values.
Of course. So it doesn't mean making yourself more vulnerable than you can tolerate. So saying yes, again, does not mean I agree to whatever you ask. It means I'm going to slow down. I'm going to suspend my inclination to block and refuse. I'm going to hear and accept what you're offering. I'm going to build on it. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to offer something, and I'm going to hope and believe that you're going to accept and build on what I'm offering.
This is really interesting. Okay, oh, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone. We're speaking with Dr. Barbara Tint, who uses the principles of improvisational theater in her work as a professor in conflict resolution at Portland State University. She also, as we've mentioned, travels around the world using these techniques as well. And to go on further, and we're going to be taking calls from listeners, by the way, so just save your questions, and we're going to get to you. But I'd like to get a little bit more into this. Like, so it's not just saying yes. There's also, as you say, it's a whole philosophy that includes mm-hmm. things like generosity, mm-hmm. spontaneity, mm-hmm. Developing presence. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit more about some of those things?
Sure. So those are all the elements. So some of them, as we've said, are accept offers, say yes, be spontaneous, allow creativity to emerge. Part of what happens when people are in conflict, again, if you're in fear, a lot of your creativity shuts down. So improvisational processes and philosophies allow us to be more creative, which allows us to find better solutions. It's building on each other's ideas. The notion of making your partner look good. Supporting your partner is a core improvisation philosophy. And when we're in conflict with somebody, we are often doing quite the opposite.
Yeah.
The looking for an attachment to a particular outcome is one of the things we do often when we're in conflict, rather than letting go of the outcome and letting the process emerge. One of the core principles, again, related mostly to Keith Johnstone's work, is around concepts of status and power, and that's present in all dynamics and certainly in all conflicts. And so that's one of the areas that I'm exploring a great deal right now. And when I work with people in conflict, that's something I'm always looking at, is where is the power? Where are the status interactions? And status in this concept really refers to what people are doing in the moment, how they're using their body, how they're using their energy, how they're using their words to up or down themselves and others. The notion of being forgiving of mistakes, taking risks, allowing yourself to step into the unknown, the uncertain. There are a lot of elements that are so core to our ability to have innovative and powerful processes. I just finished a beautiful collaboration with some colleagues, one in Australia, one in Holland, on writing an article on the use of applied improvisation for training for humanitarian aid workers. Mm-hmm. Because disaster response exactly involves the ability to step into the unknown, to step into the uncertain. Things are not business as usual when things go awry. And right. So the ability to train people to develop these skills, these muscles, so when you're faced with the uncertain, you have a skill set to deal with that.
So how do you train people? I mean, what do you actually? I mean, you know, I mean, how do you get someone to like stop being one way? It's almost like a personality that they have, to become another sort of personality in a way.
Well, a lot of what I believe, and I think people in this area believe, is that we all have it in us. When you look at children, children are improvising all the time. We're improvising all the time.
I mean, I'm on improvising some level, trying to talk
exactly,
to you.
Exactly. We're improvising right now. So we improvise every day. We don't get up every day with a script of how to run our lives. So right. We are actually all improvising every day. But I do think that sort of creative, spontaneous, and sometimes playful side of us gets beaten out of us as we grow into adults. So improvisation as a philosophy and as a set of techniques helps us find that again. And a lot of training is taking people through activities that have a particular intention. So there's a real method to it. And part of what happened for me when I discovered this modality in 2009 as a formal modality, I'd always used experiential methods in my training and teaching, but as a structured modality, I wondered, well, how do I take the work that I do, which is very heavy, serious work? I work with genocide survivors. I work in Israel, Palestine. I do a lot of very serious, heavy work. How do I bring this modality that has a lot of playfulness and a lot of freedom and spontaneity? I don't want to trivialize people's experience or trauma. And the reality is there's a great intersect and a great overlap. So on the one hand, it's being used, for example, by a colleague of mine in Hawaii on working with soldiers and war veterans mm-hmm. who have a post-traumatic stress disorder, because improv gets people into their bodies. It gets people into the present. It gets people into parts of themselves that have been frozen through trauma. There's a colleague using this in Israel, bringing people together. So the ability to work with people really is about choosing intentional activities that might focus on the cultivation of a particular skill. So some activities might focus on decision making. Mm-hmm. Some activities might focus on communication. Some activities might focus on being able to respond well in uncertainty. And then framing that as a way to work with people and then think about how they can apply it. One of our other great colleagues says that any activity is just an excuse for a good debrief.
Oh, wow.
So you don't just use the activity. You have to debrief it with people in a way that they can then make meaning of it in their own contexts.
So are these activities kind of like games that you have mm-hmm. them play?
Some of them are games. Some of them are deeper processes. And some of them are very playful and fun. And that's also one of the great things, is that most people, as far as I can tell, want to have fun.
Truly.
So it engages people on a new level. And sometimes the activities are very serious, because if there's some role play involved and people are coming from traumatized contexts, a lot of that very difficult emotion can emerge. So there are games, there are activities, there are processes. Some of them are content-based. Some of them are just very short, kind of ice-breaking activities to get people into their bodies. Any training that we do is really something very, very intentional and thought through about what we're choosing, why, what is our goal. Improv is a process, but it doesn't mean we show up in any context and wing it, which we have to sometimes. So again, to be a good trainer using improv, you go in with a agenda on some level, but you also have to be prepared to let it go, because to some degree, the process will drive what you decide to do.
Well, yeah, that's really interesting too, because like there are these like, for instance, nonviolent communication. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of a formula with that.
Exactly.
And it sounds like with what you're doing, there is really no formula, but there are some like kind of ground rules.
Exactly. Formula, no. Every context is different. Every group is different. Every situation will require something different. But again, you come with a toolbox. You come with a set of principles. You come with a set of activities that you draw from. There are hundreds of activities you might draw from.
Uh-huh.
And you also let the context drive what you do. And if you come in, as I have many times, with a certain set of activities you want to use, and you determine pretty early on that that is not where the group needs to go, you yourself need to be able to be flexible and agile enough to change direction, which is both important for any trainer and also a good way of modeling adaptability to the people you're working with.
Do you have any examples, for instance, of like when that's happened to you?
Well, all the time.
Okay.
it's happened all the time. I'll think of one specifically in a moment, but
okay.
I can't think of
one
off the top of my
head.
But
that's the sort of thing that you're kind of just on your feet dealing with this and that and the
sure.
other. Sure. Well, how about just some examples of like some activities, some specific activities?
Okay, well, do you want to do one?
Oh, we can try.
So there's one I'll make it easy on you. There's an activity called memory loss that
memory
I
loss.
Sometimes
I'm always
use.
Losing my memory.
Yeah, well, most of us are at some point. So it involves, it's based on the principles of acceptance and integration. So it's an activity, for example, that you might use with people trying to help come up with collaborative projects or collaborative ideas, the ability to build on each other's ideas and integrate other people's ideas. So I might start a story and I'm going to intermittently have a memory loss. So I will forget. Mm-hmm. And that's when you will come in and you will offer me a word or a phrase that will help me, quote unquote, remember. And I will have to build that into my story.
Okay.
Which means it's going to take my story probably in a completely different direction from where it might have gone otherwise.
And okay. And you have to be willing to do that.
Of course.
And I have to come up with whatever.
Of course.
Okay.
So last week I went camping and it was really raining, but it was great because I had a wonderful tent with a great rain fly. And I forget.
You built a fire.
Right. Yes, right. That's exactly right. So I built a fire. And when I built the fire, what happened was that the people at the campsite nearby came over because they didn't have any wood. So they came over and sat with us. And they were really, really interesting people. One of them, he
said he actually built tents like the one you were talking about.
Exactly. That's right. It was such a coincidence that he was the one who built the tents that I was using. It was such an amazing coincidence. And after that, we started talking.
You started talking about your rabbit.
Exactly. Oh, thank you for reminding me. Right. That I had a rabbit that in previous years I had taken camping with me. This year, I couldn't really take the rabbit camping because it had just had 17 little bunnies, and I just couldn't take the rabbit away.
Oh, okay. So we just go on like
right,
that.
Right, exactly. So that's an example of
okay, so now
a
how
small
do we,
activity.
How do we decompress all that afterwards
right,
or whatever?
Right. So if we were to use that activity with a group, we would then debrief by saying things, what did you notice?
Uh-huh.
What happened?
I would notice that sometimes I was trying to think ahead of what I would say, and then it wasn't even appropriate when it came to what you were coming up with.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah. So that would be an example of the benefit of really being in the moment and letting what happens in the moment emerge rather than planning ahead, which is often what we do when we're in relationship.
Right.
And we would ask questions like that. And then, depending on the context, we would ask, how might this apply to your work, your group, your community. This work is being used. It's being used at Stanford. It's being used at MIT. It's being used at Disney. It's being used at Pixar. It's being used in Oxford. It's being used all over the world for people to think about issues like leadership and creativity and humanitarian training and trauma healing. I mean, there are so many applications that how people apply it will really be relevant to their own context.
Wow. So we could even start incorporating some improv into our KBOO guidelines.
Well,
is what
of course,
you're saying.
I would hope so.
Yeah. So, how would you suggest, or what?
Well, I'd let you determine
that. Okay. So we have to just kind of.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that if we were to work together, I'd work with your group and come up with some activities that would stimulate your thinking and your collaborative energies, and then you would come up with the brilliant ideas that will help your organization because you're all experts on your context,
right?
Not me.
So, and it's more about it's not just talk. It's really playing.
Yes.
and having real different kinds of experiences with each other.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And the other thing about improv is that it's deeply relational and deeply about connection. And a lot of where conflict brings us is where our connections break down.
Mm-hmm.
So improv lets us find that place again.
Yeah, just the fact that, because I was really noticing it in the improv class that I took. Basically, it was like 2 hours of where we're mostly just laughing
mm-hmm.
all the time, which
yes.
was incredible. And
yes.
and very different people. But by the end, there was a lot of high five, great,
yes.
wonderful,
yes.
a lot of kind of support and enthusiasm for
mm-hmm.
everybody.
Yeah, it really creates a shared experience. People again, for the most part, like to laugh. They like to share experiences. They like to connect. And again, in my particular work, at least part of it, I mean, I do work in organizations and communities where there isn't deep trauma as well. But in organizations, communities where there has been a deep trauma, it's not that you want to bring in activities that are going to trivialize or marginalize what they've gone through. Again, you have to be very thoughtful and intentional about what you invite people to do.
Well, I noticed you said it's not playfulness, it's principles mm-hmm. of improv.
It can be playfulness, yeah. but not always, because right. again, depending on the activities you choose, in communities where there is deep trauma or history, there also has to be room for the painful parts to emerge, because that's part of healing. And again, depending on what your background is, you may or may not have the comfort level in managing that. I mean, again, that's part of where my background as a psychologist means I'm pretty comfortable and experienced dealing with a lot of really traumatic emotional content, but that's not the focus, it's just what sometimes might emerge.
Right. But I wanted to let listeners know again, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone, where we're trying to heal the world every month. And this month, we're speaking with Dr. Barbara Tint, who uses the principles of improvisational theater in her work as a teacher at Portland State University, and also as someone who travels the world using conflict resolution and improv techniques to help people in just a huge different variety of situations. And we're also going to be taking calls from listeners in just a few moments now, but I wanted to first just talk a little bit about what you're actually doing in real places. For instance, you're in Rwanda, mm-hmm. say. What did you do there? And were you able to use the improv there?
Well, when I was in Rwanda, I didn't use the improvisational work at the time, because at that time I was doing more research and working with communities around some of the post-genocide issues. Right now, it happens to be the 20th anniversary of the genocide in yeah. Rwanda, and I was actually supposed to be there, I think, right now. For a variety of reasons, I did not go on that trip, and I was prepared to use these principles. But there are groups using this, or some version of it, maybe more psychodrama or things like that, in Rwanda. A lot of where some of this also can be used is with children. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, in a place like Rwanda, what you have, it's, you know, you're looking at a generational thing. You have children who were orphaned during the genocide, but those children are now in their 20s or even 30s, because the genocide is 20 years old, if it's, and it's hard to believe. But then they have children. And so you have a whole society that is really trying to heal and come together in the aftermath of such a phenomenally tragic event. So again, depending on the context, the work I do also around dialogue and reconciliation is mostly what I was doing in Rwanda, working with communities on processes of coming together and having dialogue. Because what happened in Rwanda, there were only a few of the crimes that were really dealt with at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Only the highest level crimes were dealt with at that level. There were a lot of other processes called the Gacaca trials in Rwanda, which are the kind of community courts dealing with what had happened. And then there were a lot of communities, and to this day, that are still very much unhealed. I mean, there's been amazing processes of reconciliation, but this is a long-term process. So bringing people together in all kinds of ways, which might include, and again, it's not the work I've done there yet, might include bringing some of these processes together. And I would say that given that it's 20 years down the road, it's probably more feasible that I would do something like this. I probably wouldn't use improv, let's say, with a community that is dealing with the immediacy of this kind of trauma. Because again, you have to make a decision based on what the community needs. Mm-hmm. So for me, improv is, again, it's a philosophy, it's a mindset, it's a set of tools, but it's also not the only tool that I use, right. and I might not use it in a particular situation.
Because it's almost too, it's people aren't ready because they're still so hugely angry.
It might be, yeah. And again, it just depends. It really depends. But yes, you have to do a really good assessment of a situation to determine what you use. And again, I might show up with all kinds of ideas, and once I get there, throw those ideas right out the window, because that's really not what's needed.
Right. Well, how about, where is a place where you have used improv, and how did it go?
Well, I can think of both immediately recent activities. So recently I did a couple of things where I trained a group of mediators with one of my dear colleagues here in town, Brad mm-hmm. Fortier, who's a wonderful improv teacher whose improv school is Happy Improv Fun Time. And we trained a group of mediators using some of these principles. Uh-huh. And it was wonderful work because, again, both the training of this kind of work on the one hand is important and serious, and on the other hand needs to be playful and get people out of the tracks and the boxes that they typically are in, because even the training allows the people learning this work to think of new ways of being with their clients and with their communities.
And so when you were doing it, say, have there been places like you were in Amsterdam doing this too, mm-hmm, right? And mm-hmm. that was called, and you call it applied improv for
yes,
some reason.
Yes,
and
yes. That so that's mean? A really important distinction to make. Thank you for bringing us back to that. So improvisation, again, it's a philosophy that's applied to theater, to jazz music, to dance. There are all kinds of ways that improvisation happens in different contexts. Applied improvisation, which is the use of improvisational philosophies, theories, techniques in contexts for training, for facilitation, as I mentioned, for leadership cultivation, for trauma healing, all these other ways that are not necessarily related to performance. And there's a group of people around the world. So there's an organization called the Applied Improvisation Network, of which I am a part, where there are over 2,000 members mm-hmm. all around the world who are using these techniques in all kinds of ways in applied contexts.
That's pretty amazing.
It is amazing.
I wanted to open it up now to the KBOO listeners. If you want to give us a call, the phone number here is 503-231-8187, and you can call in if you have any comments or questions for Barbara. But just some funny things that I was thinking of, or not funny exactly, but there's a lot of getting stuck, it seems like, that goes on all, you know, in almost any issue that I can think about, you know. And, for instance, Congress in the United States.
Yeah, we need improv in Congress.
I mean,
for
yeah,
sure.
Could that work there? I mean, what would we do?
Well, remember the point I made about having to be invited.
So right.
That would be the first thing. Well, of right. course. I believe that these processes can be effective anywhere.
I mean, you could have, like, Republican senators and Democratic senators playing games with each other. Would that?
You could.
I mean, that would be so interesting.
Yes, it would.
Yeah.
And a lot of what also I think is the work of applied improvisers is to really convey, which I firmly believe, that this is not just frivolity. Because a lot of times you would get in a context like that a great deal of resistance. What am I doing here? I didn't come here to play games. This is ridiculous. You can
right.
get that.
I
have gotten that. And what you have to do, or at least I believe, and what I do, is really convey the seriousness and import of the underlying skills and principles that these activities foster and how they apply to the context in which we're in. So while the games might be playful, they might be fun, they might make us happy, which I think, you know, happiness is a worthwhile goal, they have such more deeply underlying bases. And that's part of our work as applied improvisers, is to really create that belief system.
Really? Okay. And we do have a caller. David, would you like to talk to Barbara for a second and just ask your question?
Yes, very much. I appreciate what you've been saying, and I'm really, really curious. Would really love to hear a specific example. I know you may have to change identifying names or the identifying situation where you can say there was this XYZ conflict. Party A was doing this or felt this, Party B was doing this, and then you went in there and worked with them using improv. If you could say what you did and how the process went and what the outcome was, I would love to hear a specific example.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sure. Well, I also want to be clear that because improv is both a philosophy as well as a set of tools and techniques, I'm using them differently. And I tend to use them more directly when I train. When I'm working with groups in conflict, I tend to use it more as a philosophy in my own mind, which means it's going to help me frame questions with the people I work with. It's going to mm-hmm. help me look for those places of collaboration. It's going to help me frame things in a way that will encourage people's acceptance of each other. What my mind immediately goes to in your question, some of the work I did do with the African communities, because what we had were groups of people who really were coming with tremendous historical trauma. We had people who were afraid to be in the room with each other. We had people who wouldn't eat the food at the meetings we had because they had had relatives who had died through poisoning. Wow. So we had tremendous difficulty and trauma with the groups that we worked with. And so some of what we did in those groups were very, 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 very simple activities where maybe we would pair them off and get them to do something even very, very, very playful as a way to just break the ice, as a way to help them see that they share certain things. Some of the ways we work with storytelling allow them to see that their story was important and valid, and it was actually not that different from the story of the person that they saw as their enemy. So it was a really valuable tool in helping us build cohesion in the groups so that there was a certain way in which we built safety, and that when some of the more difficult issues emerged later on, that safety and connection had been established. So that's one idea that comes to my mind.
And then how did it end up? I mean, were these people actually becoming friends when you were done?
Yes. I would like to say that's one of the most rewarding projects I've been on. So this was a project that went for about 5 years, from about 2007 to about 2012. And we did have community members who previously would have been afraid to be in the same room, going to each other's homes, going to each other's community celebrations. We had several rounds of dialogue where then community members were trained. So it was built as a capacity building project. So we had community members who were then trained, who then facilitated the next round of groups. I had people become students of mine because they were so compelled. We actually have written a book, which is going to come out next year, about this work. And yes, it changed communities, that there were small NGOs started as a result of this among the youth. We had Rwandese and Congolese communities coming together. And other groups around the country couldn't believe that we got people to sit down together, because some of the divisions in the refugee communities was so, so great. Because again, people were coming. The very reason that people had become refugees followed them. And those were typically war and conflict.
Right. And they're still ready to, you know, this almost gives me like a chill of like hopefulness.
Well, that would be the idea.
I mean, this would be amazing. I mean, and so say for instance then that we had like, okay, here's another one that's a big one for me, is climate change, mm-hmm. you know, and like it, sometimes these things just seem so intractable, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
Like where you just have people, I just don't believe you, you know, but part of this seems like you have to get the parties together.
Of course. And the reality with any process is you cannot force people to be where they're not ready to be. I tend to approach situations from meeting people where they're at. So if people come with a lot of resistance, then I meet them at that resistance and work with that in some way, where I accept their resistance. So that's part of accepting. You can't say, no, you can't resist, because that's blocking,
right.
Actually. So you have to accept their resistance as part of the process. I have another wonderful colleague who's very, very prominent in the field of climate change, who is working very deeply in the area of games and simulations. And he has, in the last few years, joined us in the applied improv world, because there are a lot of ways, especially when you're coming into local communities, where what are you going to do? Stand up there with a 2-hour PowerPoint, especially if language is an issue? Or are you going to engage people in processes that get them to think about things, that get them to consider questions and possibilities that they might not have other ways? So it's absolutely being used in that area.
Uh-huh. And you find yourself like then, okay, I'm thinking of like when it's just like people online, mm-hmm. just saying things back and forth. Mm-hmm. You do have to get people in the same room together, it sounds like. You can't just have processes that work mm-hmm. through letters to the editor.
Well, I'll say that I'm a big person-to-person person.
Yeah.
But there are people who do this kind of work online. They have facilitated processes online. There are improv activities or processes that are being developed as online systems that people can tap into. Let's face it, we are in the world of social media. I don't think there's any way around it.
Yeah.
So for my purposes, certainly to the degree that we can get people together, it's great, but we also need to have alternative modalities. I will also say that depending on the conflict, depending on the context, and depending on the culture, face-to-face work is not always the best choice. Uh-huh. There are some cultures that would not support that because a more indirect approach is favored, where it's often deeply shameful or causing a loss of face to maybe bring people together of different hierarchies of or different situations to resolve a conflict. So it's not always the preferred way.
Uh-huh, interesting. We do have another caller. What was her name again? Joanne. Joanne, I'll get you in a second. I just want to let listeners know that this is KBOO Portland. I am speaking with Dr. Barbara Tint, who teaches at PSU and actually all over the world. She teaches conflict resolution and uses the techniques of improv in her work, improvisational theater. So, Joanne, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I have a question. I wanted to ask your guest, what about somebody in this country, somebody like me, where do they go to do this? Somebody like me who's low income and been working for years trying to get out of low income, reaching out and not getting the support or help, and doing an awful lot of thinking and getting an awful lot of awareness of my own country and its people, and realizing the problem for me is capitalism, the economic system I live in. It creates classism in that, and it brainwashes people to think and be a certain way. So is there some place in this country for somebody like me to learn this work? Anyway, I'll leave the phone.
Well, I hope so. I don't know of all what's available to you or what's not available to you, so I support your motivation and interest in trying to find these things. There are certainly places, probably in most cities, certainly in Portland, where you can participate in improvisational theater. I don't know if that's what you're talking about.
And it's fun.
And I do think it helps us think about things differently. That's the first thing. But I think your question is something different. And what your question makes me think about is the work that I'm developing with another colleague around power and around status. And that is really relevant to everything that we do. And I don't know all the answers to that question, but I do think we can't work alone, that we need to find communities and groups of people who can think about these things together. I don't know that we can upend capitalism, but we can think about how to move more nimbly within it.
And so, yeah, so you said it earlier that you are doing work with status, mm-hmm. rank, and power. Mm-hmm. What does that actually mean? What are you doing?
Well, we're still trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
So status, as I described earlier, at least from the frame of improvisation, is really related to what's happening in the moment. So if we were to be on TV, you could see that, you know, I'm really high status right now.
Right. She's got her arms spread out, right. And I'm a little hunched over.
Right,
in
right. Or I might be low status, right? So uh-huh. That's kind of how we think about status. Or I might say, wow, you look so great today. And that would be my trying to elevate your status.
Uh-huh.
So it's both verbal and physical in the moment. And the colleague that I'm working with has been an expert on status for a number of years. And when I discovered improv, I continued to be confused because I didn't understand how that related to other issues that we also often conflate with status, such as power. So my work had been very much around both structural and personal issues of power, issues mm-hmm. of race, issues of class, issues of gender, issues of culture. And we began to look at the intersective, so status, power as those phenomenon, rank. So are you the CEO or are you the secretary? Are
right.
you the general? Are you the private? Are you the elder? Are you the youth? And the fourth element in this framework we're looking at is esteem, is how those things impact how you feel inside and how those things you feel inside actually impact how you access your forms of power or how they impact your status behavior. So those four elements together, we've developed a framework around that, and we're thinking about how that applies to leadership and conflict resolution diversity training and organizational team building. There are all kinds of ways, well, in my opinion, every way in which these elements come together. And I think we believe that if we can make these processes more conscious and more intentional and give people more choices within the structures that we live, that it will improve both the individual and the social contexts.
Well, it sounds like a lot of this would be really important to be teaching in schools, you know, because it seems that we live in a culture right now, like the whole Occupy movement versus the 1% or something is just, it's kind of like, it's in the system, and to change the system is kind of like what you're talking about ultimately doing.
I believe that we have to impact, we have to impact whatever sphere of influence we're in, right? Congress hasn't called me yet, so I can't go and work with them.
Right.
If you're listening, Congress, I'm happy to come.
Yeah.
But I can work with the groups and organizations that I work with, and you just don't know which seeds that you plant that will sprout somewhere else.
Right.
So I just believe that we have to be peace, you know, to quote Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Vietnamese peace scholar and Buddhist monk. We have to be peace in our world and our work. We have to convey the tools and the techniques that help other people be peace in some other way. And it's self-reinforcing, because when people begin to experience the changes that can come of these processes, they want to use them more. If you reference the Occupy movement, that's a great example of the difference between rank and power. So a lot of the people in the Occupy movement might not have had high rank in our social structure, but there was a lot of power in the numbers. There was a lot of power in the voice that people amassed collectively.
Right. Right. And then the power then becomes as important as rank or status or anything else.
There's an interchange. And again, you have to see where these things come together.
But the problem I see it often is that, maybe as a huge group, I have a lot of power, but Mr. Koch, you know, or a Supreme Court justice or something has this tremendous power. It's just one person.
Yes. So that's certainly true. So that high rank often does come with a lot of power attached to it. One of the things that we're looking at in our work is that we're trying to help people see that power isn't something you either have or you don't, that there are different kinds of power. So certainly when you're looking at issues of race or class or gender, we can't equalize things and say, oh, everybody has different kinds of power, because clearly we come into the world into the structures that are embedded, and that if you're on the lower end of that structural hierarchy, you are challenged in different ways. That's a given. And so that's a yes. And and what other kinds of powers can be cultivated to help us navigate, again, more nimbly within some of those structures? So I think, again, the Occupy movement was a great example of that, because the power of numbers, the power of voice, the power of resistance. The whole nonviolence movement, as one of my colleagues at the university has spent his whole life working in the nonviolent movement sector, that there has been tremendous change in the world because of those kinds of movements. Think about Martin Luther King. Think about Gandhi. Think about Susan B. Anthony. I mean, these are changes that happen through nonviolent action.
Right. And another huge part of this then is the idea of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. I mean, like sometimes I think it's hard for people to feel like they can forgive the people who have a lot of power who are abusing it.
Of course. Of course. Well, forgiveness is not something that can be mandated. Forgiveness is an internal process. Mm-hmm. We can cultivate processes or conditions that might be more likely to invite people into a state of forgiveness. But forgiveness is really an internal process, and people get there in their own way and time. And it's also much more difficult to forgive if the injury is ongoing.
Yes.
Right? So, for example, in the case of Rwanda, there have been miraculous stories of forgiveness. I mean, so unbelievable what people have forgiven. I think that part of that is because, at least in the moment, this ongoing conflict and violence has not continued. In Israel, for example, it's much more difficult,
right,
because the ongoing conflict and violence is really interfering. And it doesn't mean there have not also been great acts of forgiveness there. But it's very challenging. And look, you think about someone like Nelson Mandela, who spent 27 years in jail. What kind of spirit can come out of that and work for good? I mean, not all of us can do that.
Right, right. It's huge. And so what would you say is, like, then for you, maybe the most important part of all this? I mean, or is there a most important part?
Yeah. Well, if we go back to the principles of improvisation, I think that really the foundational ones are say yes, receive, build on what others offer, and be collaborative, make others look good, try to find the good in what others are offering. And again, when we're in conflict or when we're our own fear, it's more difficult to do so. But when you try to live your life that way, which on my good days I can, on my normal days it's harder, life gets better. And it doesn't just get better for you. It gets better for the people around you because there's a contagion. So there's a notion of reciprocity in my work where, you know, more collaborative processes will elicit more collaborative responses, often, not always. And so it has a ripple effect.
Mm-hmm.
It really has a ripple effect.
And I remember, like, one person saying, like, and this was the improv class, how is it affecting you? They were saying that, well, I just feel like I'm having more fun with my friends now.
Uh-huh.
And someone else was talking about how using improv helps you get along better with children.
Absolutely.
You know?
I will say, just on a purely personal level, that when I started taking improv classes in 2009, and I sort of haven't stopped, it made my life much better. Just on a personal level, I was happier. I mean, again, when you're playing, right, it accesses a part of yourself that may have been shut down. It opens doorways and pathways. I find myself waking up in the morning and my creative juices were just flowing in ways they hadn't been in other times of my life. So on a purely personal level, I would say that the world would be a much better place if everyone took improv classes. I have another colleague who's about to launch a world tour to write a book on how improv can save the world.
Great.
And there are a lot of us out there. As I said, the Applied Improvisation Network has over 2,000 members and growing. We have an annual conference every year. So it's there.
And just the final little bit then. So getting back to Joanne's question, a KBOO listener who wanted to get involved in this, what would you suggest?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say if you're able, I would certainly say take improv classes. There are many opportunities, you know, here in Portland, as I mentioned, Happy Improv Fun Time. There's also the Brody Theater. There's the Liberators, great improv teachers and performers. There are a lot of articles. If you even just Googled Applied Improvisation or Improvisation and Leadership, if you Googled some of those things, you'd see articles. I have my computer's getting full because of my file of improv articles.
Uh-huh.
So there are a lot of places where this is being used. There are articles and links online. I would say read about it. There's a wonderful book called, forgetting the name of the book, Patricia Ryan Madsen wrote a wonderful book called Improv Wisdom.
Ah,
right. It's the book Improv Wisdom. Subtitle is "Don't Prepare, Just Show Up." It's a wonderful book that's being translated into all kinds of languages right now. I think it's a great starting point to understand some of the improv principles. But again, she writes about it in how it will affect your daily life, and that's a great start if you just want to think about how improv in your own life can make a difference.
Improv Wisdom.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, just being more playful. It's just it's got to be a more human way of functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I would love to start seeing it in schools. Do you see that happening?
I think it's a great idea. I think there are people using it in schools for teaching with young children. I mean, certainly there are a lot of activities that people use that they might not even know are actually based in improv. A lot of warm-up activities that are being redefined and designed in other contexts probably root in improv. And again, I invite the listeners to do an experiment in their lives. Just spend a week saying yes where you might normally say no and see what happens.
Just say yes. Yeah. Over and over again.
Around low-risk things. Don't do anything that's too risky.
Would you like another bowl of ice cream?
Yeah. Well, sure. I always say yes to that.
That kind of thing. But whatever. Yeah. Just the whole idea of being yes to the world, it just sort of opens up so many things. It just opens up your eyes, actually.
It does. And again, for the most part, people want the same thing, and we all suffer when there are barriers between us. And so if we can remember that and work toward collaborative, spirited endeavors, we can hope that other people will do the same.
Yeah, it's as you say, it's basically remembering that we're all connected just with our humanity. Mm-hmm. If we can just start opening to that. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Say yes.
Say yes. Well, anyway, I just want to let you know that I want to thank you, Barbara,
You're
for
welcome.
Being here. And let the cable listeners know we've been speaking with Barbara Tint. She uses the principles of improvisational theater in her work as a professor of conflict resolution at Portland State University. She's a trainer and a facilitator in conflict resolution around the world. And maybe if we all learned improv, we could save the world. This has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland, and I want to thank Tammy for engineering, Kevin McLeod for the royalty-free music, and I'm Stephanie Potter, and thanks for listening.
And in just half a minute, it'll be 12 o'clock noon. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Nick is here to bring you Jazz Lives. And after one announcement and then the KBOO news at noon. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO today. See you next week.
Pioneering Oregon filmmaker Penny Allen is coming to Portland's Hollywood Theater this Saturday and Sunday for a two-night retrospective of her breakthrough independent films, including newly remastered prints of the 1978 Sundance Award winner Property, the 1981 classic Pay Dirt, and her recent feature Late for My Mother's Funeral, set in France and Algeria. This KBOO-sponsored event features Q&A sessions with Penny, as well as scheduled guests Gus Van Sant, Eric Edwards, and Walt Curtis. It all happens this Saturday and Sunday, April 26th and 27th, at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. More information can be found online at hollywoodtheater.org.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, April 23, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, President Obama visited the site of the Washington mudslide Tuesday. Besides seeing the devastation created, the president also witnessed the tremendous support provided by the community and volunteers from the surrounding area. The president met with the victims of the mudslide as well as first responders. While many people in this area are fairly conservative, there was widespread enthusiasm in response to the president's visit.
New information is being discovered in the investigation into the causes for the Como News helicopter crash in Seattle last month.